It's an honor and a privilege to welcome a very close friend, a person that I learned and spent a lot of time with in Kollel, Rav Kellerman, and I learned 2-3 years together, Ruta, and he actually started the Kollel, so I have a Karas HaTofim for that also. And I don't know if you guys read the sign outside about Professor Kellerman, but I can tell you that seeing him on a daily basis for years at a time, that Rav Kellerman is a Yirei Shemayim, a Baal Musar, who works on himself on a daily basis. He's Mezakeh Tarabim, and he brings people closer and closer to Hashem and Yahadut, and it is an honor to have him here speaking to us tonight, right before Yom HaKippurim, and we are anticipating your words of Chizuk and enthusiasm.
Rabbi Shmuel is very kind. He says we learn together. Lemaisa, he taught me everything. So I apologize for being late tonight. I've been on the road for about 8 weeks, and I just got back, and maybe I'll just introduce with one story from the road. Interesting things happen to you when you're on the road. So I'm traveling on a plane, and you know I only sleep about 4 hours a night when I'm on these trips, and so I'm completely exhausted. And there's no such thing as jet lag by me. I put my head down, I fall asleep anytime. So I got on a plane, and I you know, Baruch Hashem, I got the window seat, which is good for me. And I just went over, and before takeoff, I just pulled a blanket over my head, and I was out before takeoff. So what I didn't notice was that this huge guy came and he sat down next to me, and after the plane took off, this guy, I'm sleeping, and I suddenly feel someone poking my leg. So I pulled down the blanket, and there's this huge guy there, and he's smiling. And I said, "What do you want?" He says, "Let's play." So I just pulled the blanket over my head and went back to sleep. Yeah. 2 minutes later, I feel this guy is like grabbing my leg and shaking it. So I pulled down the blanket and said, "What do you want?" He said, "Let's play." I said, "What do you want to play?" So he says to me, he says, "Let's ask each other questions." So I couldn't believe this. I said, "What do you want to ask?" He says, "I'll ask you a question. If you don't know the answer, you pay me a dollar. Then you ask me a question. If I don't know the answer, I'll pay you a dollar." So I just pulled the blanket back over. So he shakes me again. I said, "What do you want?" He says, "I'll ask you a question. You don't know the answer, you pay me a dollar. You ask me a question. If I don't know the answer, I'll pay you $100. I pulled the blanket down. I said, "Let's play." So he asked me, "What was the tallest mountain in Western Africa?" So I took out my wallet, I peeled off a dollar bill, I handed it to him, I said, "I have no idea." I said to him, "What animal is colored primarily red and blue and always walks on its hands, never its legs?" So he looked at me, he had this big smile, he said, "That's a good question." So I said, "Think about it." And I pulled the blanket over my head. So I hear him, like, he's talking to himself, like, he's saying we're red and blue, and walks on his hands only. So then I hear him getting up, and he's like rummaging with something. I don't know exactly what he was up to. He's rummaging around, and then I see he's pulled out his laptop, and he goes on American Airlines Go-Go internet service, and he's like trying to find on the internet, what is this thing? So I fell asleep. It was about 2 hours later, he starts poking me again. So I took the blanket. I said, "What do you want?" So he said, "He says I give up." And he's got this $100 bill that he's giving me. So I said, "I don't want the $100. I just want to go to sleep. Leave me alone." So he says, no, you deserve it. Take the $100. I don't know the answer. Take the $100. So I said, no. He says, just take it. I was like, fine, just to stop it. I took the $100. Yeah. So he says, I pulled the blanket back. He says, no, what's the answer? I pulled the blanket back. I said, I don't know. Just made it up. I don't know. I think that's fine. Okay. I want to talk to you about something serious. I want to talk to you about some thoughts that I've been having as Yom Kippur's approaching. A serious question I've been asking myself. And the question is like this. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that this story called Olam Hazeh is going to end one of two ways. Mashiach is either going to come and greet a generation which is entirely evil, or he's going to come and greet a generation which is entirely righteous. So, the more that I thought about that, the more frightening it became for me, because when I look around the world today and see the condition of things, if I was compelled and I had to guess which of these two scenarios it's going to be, it's a little scary to think about how it might end. Either Klal Yisrael will return en masse to the Torah. We will morally transform mankind. And Mashiach will arrive to congratulate us. Or God forbid, Klal Yisrael will abandon Torah. We'll be swallowed up in a burgeoning riptide of assimilation. Mankind will tear carelessly down a road of self-destruction, and Mashiach will have to arrive to bail us out of this disaster. So the second scenario, the dark scenario, I think I understand well. Rates of white-collar and blue-collar crime throughout the first world have never been higher. The last two centuries, most famous atheists, Stalin and Hitler, killed more people than were killed in the pogroms, the jihad, the crusades combined. A writer who I'm quite fond of, George Steiner, is a professor at the University of Kent at Canterbury, recently made the following declaration. He said, "There is hardly a methodology of objection and of pain which is not being applied somewhere at this moment to individuals and groups of human beings." Even worse, the most civilized nations on this planet failed to give any sort of haven from the spiraling malevolence that is flooding the universe. There was recently a study done at Stanford. Professor Donald Lund there reported the following. "Statistically, a child born anywhere in the United States today has a 1 in 200 chance of being murdered sometime during his lifetime. A child born and growing up in high crime areas of certain cities, like Atlanta or Philadelphia, has a 1 in 50 chance of being murdered sometime during his lifetime. Children raised in the Tenderloin or Fillmore areas of San Francisco have a 1 in 70 chance of being murdered sometime during their lifetime. And these are only the rates for being murdered. These are nothing like the rates of, let's say, rape, which are 4 times higher in the United States than the murder rates. Our political leadership, from the local to the state to the national level, both in Israel and in the U.S., is totally and absolutely corrupt. selfishness is ubiquitous among the non-criminal. Divorce, spousal abuse rates, child abuse rates are at record levels. In, for me, what was a terrifying move, one state in the U.S., Oregon, recently passed a law which allows any two doctors with patient consent to perform euthanasia. And today, HMO executives all across America are lobbying for similar bills to be passed in their states because the cost of euthanasia is so much less than the cost of esoteric treatments. Leaders all across the world, France, Denmark, Russia, China, are also totally corrupt. The former prime minister of this country might be the first to land in jail. And the current prime minister is a confessed adulterer. Openly said it, that he did it. Private industries and governments worldwide prostitute themselves, selling the most dangerous and the most despicable products and services for a price. And in the middle of all this, Jewry, intended to be the light unto the nations and to help mankind out of this homemade hell, is in the process of committing cultural and demographic suicide. Just 6 weeks ago, Professor Barry Cosman and Ariella Kesar of Trinity College, the Trinity College Institute for the Study of Secularism, released the following findings, which I believe is the most comprehensive study of Jewish assimilation rates since the 1990 National Jewish Population Survey. They found, number one, today, half of all marrying American Jews have married non-Jews, with the result that there are two, quote-unquote, mixed households for every new Jewish household. The number of American Jews who identify themselves as Jewish has dropped in the last 20 years by the number 750,000. In only 20 years, 750,000 American Jews have disappeared from the face of the planet demographically. This is unbelievable. Of the 5.3 million American Jews who constitute what's called the core group, this latest survey released 6 weeks ago shows of the 5.3 million, only 3.6 million are halachically Jewish. There are only 3.6 million halachically Jewish Jews in America. That's about 68% of the Jewish population. 32% of the people in America who call themselves Jews are goyim. They're not Jewish. And by the way, you're talking primarily about the people whose last names are Cohen and Schwartz. It's the Christiansens who probably are Jewish. And even more shocking, it's not just the fringes of American Jewry where this decay is taking place. They found in this most recent study, 44% of those Jews who identify themselves as being religiously observant or orthodox claim to have, quote unquote, a secular worldview. That is, they walk the walk, they talk the talk, and they're already spiritually dead. We are just waiting for the statistics to show up. We're waiting for the intermarriage to take place. But these people already have told us they look at the world through secular glasses. Dr. Barry Cosman commented on the findings of his study, quote, "I attribute the shift to a combination of disaffection from Judaism and intermarriage." Now, Jewry certainly seems to have failed the test of the West. I have theories about that, why that might be true. It could be that when our great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-great-grandparents fled Europe, there was just no time for the Gedolim of that generation to prepare them for what they were about to encounter in America. And so they just fell into America completely unprepared for the challenge that would come, or it could be, that no one could have foreseen what the tests of wealth, and specifically the test of the university, would be like for American Jewry. I specifically mention the university because that is where most of the unraveling is taking place today in America. For whatever the reason, the numbers suggest that you and I will witness approximately, the rates will actually change about once a decade, but you and I will witness approximately 10 million, sorry, yes, I'm sorry, approximately 1 million Jews demographically disappear from American Jewry every 10 years for the next several decades. Now, those numbers will actually speed up as we get towards the end, and then they'll suddenly stall out when it hits the core of Orthodoxy. But you'll see about 1 million Jews disappear over the next 10 years. I remember when this was being predicted 30 years ago, and I remember thinking that these were alarmist demographers. But now it's happened, and we're going to watch the, God forbid, the end of the unraveling. God forbid. We live in darkness. And I think I understand well how we could dig ourselves into an inescapably deep pit that only God could dig us out of. But how do I understand the Talmud's brighter scenario? That Mashiach is going to come to greet a nation, a group of Jews that are entirely righteous? Numerically, people like you and I are insignificant. We're the 8%, the 7% of the 1/3 of 1% of mankind who actually knows Torah and wants to do something about it. We possess the barest understanding of Torah. We possess almost no understanding of how human beings function. We've been robbed of our sages, of the great tradition that existed pre-World War II. Where is there any hope of light? At this moment, when God looks down on planet Earth, where does he see the solution? Where does he see that it's all going to be okay? The following occurred to me. The Vilna Gaon and the Baal Shem Tov failed to bring the Mashiach. Rav Yosef Cairo failed to bring the Mashiach. Rashi, the Ramban, and the Rambam failed to bring the Mashiach. Rav Yehuda Nasi failed to bring the Mashiach. Ravina and Ravashi failed to bring the Mashiach. Mordechai and Esther failed. The Maccabees failed. Ezra failed. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel failed to bring the Mashiach. Shmuel, Eliyahu, and Elisha failed to bring the Mashiach. And we're going to bring the Mashiach? And yet, that's the Hava Mina. So what was the Hava Mina? What were Chazal thinking? Baruch Kadsham, what were they thinking? Looking forward in the direction things were going, what were they thinking when they said it could end that way? If you ask me, on September the 24th, 2009, a few hours before Yom Kippur, how is the whole thing going to end? Is it going to be Mashiach coming to greet a generation that's entirely righteous or entirely evil? So I have to confess, at this point in my life and at this point in history, it is pasha to me. There is no question in my mind that Mashiach is going to come and greet a generation which is entirely righteous. And I'll spend the next few minutes trying to explain to you why I believe that. There's a Mishnah that you're all familiar with that says, Lufum Tsara Agra, according to the struggle, according to the difficulty, so is the reward. Now you know and I know that when the Torah promises reward, it's not some synthetic, arbitrary gift. It's not like, you know, you do 100 mitzvahs and you get 100 bananas when you get to the next world. That's not the way that it works. When it talks about Lufum Tsara Agra, the reward is, who do I become? How much light does my neshama release into the world? How bright does my beam become? Lufum Tsara Agra says, the more that you struggle, then the more light you put out into the world. It turns out then that the key determining factor as to how much of an impact you and I have on the world is whether or not, when the nisayon comes, when push comes to shove, when I'm asked to do something that's really painful or really difficult, do I step forward to that challenge? Stepping forward is the key. It could be that externally, previous generations achieved far more than anyone in this generation ever could. But internally, from the Lufum Tsara Agra perspective, because it could be so difficult for us to do the right thing in this generation, we might be generating more light. Now, I'm not making this whole crazy thing up. This is actually a medrash. There's a medrash in Koheles Rabbah, Perek Aleph, Kapitel Ches. There on the pasuk, Al Tomar Mehaya, don't ask, oi, what's happened? Sheyami Rishonim Hayu Tovim Eile, the older generations, the previous generations were much better than this generation. On that pasuk, the Medrash says, Am Rabbi Brachya, see, the pasuk says, V'yoyada Hanagi La'aram. Yoyada was the teacher of Aram. What do you mean Yoyada was the teacher of Aram? Yoyada lived 450 years after Aram. How could Yoyada have been the teacher of Aram? Aram was long dead, and Yoyada was much, 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 much younger than him, so to speak, 450 years later. Yoyada, after all of that, Yeridus Adoros, he even could have been the teacher of Aram? Explains the Midrash, Ella, Ilu haya Aaron kayem bedor shel Yoyada. If Aaron would have lived in a generation as dark as the generation of Yoyada, Yoyada haya gadol mimenu b'shaiso. Yoyada would have been much greater than Aaron in that generation. Aaron was that great because he lived in a very bright generation. Yoyada was so small relative to Aaron because he lived in a very dark generation where it was very difficult to achieve spirituality. Now again, if this seems too theoretical, I'll make it very concrete. There's an astounding sefer. It's called Shivchei Rav Chaim Vital. I don't know, I'm pretty sure that it's not in print anymore, but you can get it on the Otzer HaChma. You can find it there, and if you've never seen it, it's worth sitting down for 15 minutes and reading some of the stories. Shivchei Rav Chaim Vital was written by Rav Chaim Vital, the Arizal's Gabbai, his Talmud Muvak. And there, Rav Chaim Vital records the most astounding stories about his Rebbe. So I have sitting in front of me a transcript of a conversation that took place between Rav Chaim Vital and his Rebbe, the Arizal. So Rav Chaim says, Eich ata omer li shenafshi hi maila kol kach. Why do you keep telling me, Rebbe, that I have such a high soul? V'harei, Rebbe, you know, Katan Shebedoros HaRishonim, the smallest person who lived in previous generations, Hayatzadik V'chasid She'en Ani Magil Ikvo. He was a tzadik and a chasid so great that I don't reach up to his ankle. So why, Rebbe, do you keep saying I'm so big? The Arizal answered, Da, You must know. Ki gedulas hanefesh eina teluya kefi maisa ha'adam. The greatness of a soul is not measured by the particular concrete details of the acts that somebody performs. Rak kefi hazman v'hador hahu. It's measured according to the generation and the time that that person lives in. Ki maisa katan me'od b'dor hazeh, because a very small act in this generation, the Arizal said, "Shakol kikama mitzvahs b'doras harishonim." It's as great as many, many, many mitzvahs that were performed in previous, much greater generations. Ki b'doros elu, in this generation, the Arizal said, "Haklipa goveret me'od me'od." The klipa, the darkness, is very, very thick. Ad ein kates, infinitely thick. Masha ein kein b'doros harishonim, which is not the case in previous generations. In the Arizal's generation, the Arizal said, the darkness is very, very thick. Nebuch. The Arizal probably only ascended once a day into the heavens. In those days, his neighbor, Rav Yosef Karo, used to learn with a magid. Yeah, I used to sit down across from someone with wings. Learn Gemara together. I think I actually learned Chumash. Yeah. It was a darkness was very, very thick in those generations. You can imagine. Now, if the darkness was called very, very thick during the times of the Arizal and Rav Yosef Karo, what would you call it today? Can we use exponents? So if the smallest mitzvah during the time of Rechaim Vital was greater than the greatest mitzvah that had been done by Rashi and Ramban. So then what is a small mitzvah worth Bizman Hazeh? How much light does that produce? What's the source of our strength? It's our openness. It's our integrity. It's our courage. It's our willingness to undergo pain. It's our willingness to step forward. That's the key, to step forward. I imagine that there is probably not a large percentage of the people sitting in this room who needed to attend tonight's class in order to get credit for college. I imagine those people who are sitting by their computers in America, they're probably not even going to get continuing education credits for this. You get no kavod for being here. What on earth are you doing up at this hour of the night? So my guess is you probably came here because Yom Kippur is almost upon us, and burning inside of you is a desire to do the right thing. That you're looking for some inspiration, you're looking for some clarity. You would love to be the sort of person who steps forward, and you're hoping that something will happen tonight which will help you do that. I call people like you morally responsible individuals. And a few of you doing very small things can have a huge, huge impact on the world. I'll share something personal. I'm 48 years old. But after 48 years on the planet, I would not say that I have a lot of close friends. I am very proud that I have a few. The reason I don't have a lot is I'm very, very picky. I like to spend my time with people who I have admiration for. And so I've collected this group of people. It's my most precious possessions, are these extraordinary human beings who I've discovered who walk the planet, who are trying to make a difference. They're trying to step forward. So I'll tell you about one of them tonight. My best friend, a fellow who I've known for a very, very long time, I met when I was in university. I met him and my wife the same month. We were on an academic program together. And I really fell in love with him. He's really an extraordinary person. Alex is an idealist. When I first met him, he and I and my wife, we were all talking about, like, how do we make a difference? And my wife and I decided that, you know, like, we have got to go to yeshiva. We're going to learn Torah, we're going to make a difference. And Alex said, you know, I've got to make aliyah, I've got to move to Eretz Yisrael, I've got to make a difference. And Alex got on a plane and arrived at Ben-Gurion. And when he walked into Ben-Gurion, he was a new ole. He said to one of the officials there, I just arrived, I'd like to join the army. And they said, you know, you can unpack your bags first. So they told him, you have to go to the Katsina Ir, we don't deal with it at the airport. Alex just wanted to fight to save Jewish lives. He, the next morning, arrived at the Katsina Ir. And he walked in and he said, I arrived yesterday and I don't want to waste time, draft me. And the Katsina Ir said, you know, you have 3 months, we'll talk to you in 3 months. We don't talk to anybody before 3 months. And Alex said, if you don't talk to me now, I'll sue you. He wanted to save Jewish lives. He didn't want to waste time. This life is too precious. It's too short. So the Katsina Ir interviewed him, and he said, you know, you really want to join the army? And he said, yeah. And he said, you know, listen, if you want to join the army, you're probably crazy. You're probably not going to get accepted. He said, no, I really want to join. So Alex fought his way in long before they normally would have drafted him. He fought his way into the army. And they took him. As soon as he got in, he applied for an officer's training course. They gave him the physical. Alex has asthma and flat feet. So they said, you're not even going to survive as a guard at the Kotel. But he fought and fought and fought, and eventually he drove them so crazy. They said, you know, listen, if you want to die, fine, we'll put you into an officer's training course. And they took him into an officer's training course, and he finished the officer's training course, and he actually became an officer in the IDF. At which point, as soon as he had done that, he applied as to transfer to the Dubzavan. And they said, you know, physically you're not capable of doing this. And he said, that never got in my way before. And he fought his way into the Dubzavan. As soon as he was into the Dubzavan, he applied for an officer's training course. And he slowly, slowly, slowly fought his way all the way to the top until he was finally second in charge of one of the most elite units in this country. And what's so amazing about Alex is that he's not just a warrior. He's a poet, and he's an artist. And I don't mean this metaphorically. He's really a poet, and he's really an artist, and he writes the most spectacular poetry, and he draws the most beautiful pictures. He's mamash a David HaMelech in our generation. And I have many of Alex's drawings, and I have a lot of his poetry. And I brought a poem tonight that I wanted to read to you. This poem was written on August the 17th, 1986. Alex was just completing the course to take command of his elite unit. And from the base, he wrote the following poem. Once in a while, as I progress towards the course's end, I feel a pang of fear. If the war comes, when the war comes, I will have to lead men to die. And I will have to have the calm power to yell to them. Or to whisper. Kadima. Step forward. And I will have to have the calm power to step forward myself. Alex only wanted to do the right thing. That's what drove him. That's what animated him. That's what he lived for. He was terrified that in the moment when it came, he would fail the test and not do the right thing. That's what he agonized over. Just over a year later, on September the 15th, 1987, on Alex's 25th birthday, there were terrorists in southern Lebanon that were tossing Katyushas onto innocent men, women, and children in northern Israel. And they airlifted Alex's unit up to Har Dov to try to clean out the cliffs. Alex's unit was ambushed, and his commander was very seriously wounded. The commander was trapped alone under enemy fire. Alex was instantly promoted to be the commander of his unit. His dream came true. And he then had to make a decision if he should abandon the mission and come back and clean things up in the morning when it could be done safely, or he should risk his own life. And my best friend, my idealist, my hero, stepped forward to aid his dying commander and fell to a terrorist bullet on a rocky hill in southern Lebanon. He was only 25 years old, but he was a mensch. He was a Jew. He's what we all aspire to be. I don't have first-hand knowledge of what's going on in the smaller population centers in America, cities and towns with 50,000 Jews or under. I do know that Denver's intermarriage rate is hovering around 70%. Vancouver's around 75%. There are cities throughout the whole southeastern part of the United States where the Gentiles are marking old synagogues as reminders of where there was once Jewish communities. There are about 625,000 American Jews who currently declare they are practicing other religions. There's a million American Jewish children under the age of 18 who are either practicing another religion or raised with no religion whatsoever. And you got to realize the rot goes much, much further. Of the 5.5 million Jews in the core group, only 2 million actually belong to synagogues or have ever given to a Jewish charity. We've lost about 4 million Jews in about 30 years. That's a greater percentage of Jews than were lost during the Holocaust. And what's amazing is there is no uproar. There are no emergency meetings. So far, we built 19 Holocaust memorials, 36 research centers of the Holocaust. Billions are being spent on dead Jews, and only pennies are being allocated for revamping a corrupt Jewish education. This is the new reality. Never before in Jewish history, not ever, has our community been led by an oligarchy, by people who are almost entirely ignorant of Jewish values, Jewish texts, and they merit leading our community only because they have money. You don't have to be a veteran sociologist to see the writing on the wall. We've got maybe 15 or 20 years left of the organized Jewish community as you and I grew up with it, as we know it today. I just saw a study. Every year, there are approximately 2,000 new Balei Tshuva in America. And every year, Jews for Jesus in America converts about 3,500 Jews. We have got to convey our message to millions of Jews. We've got to reach out to these alienated individuals and tell them the Jewish life abounds with positive, joyous, quintessentially relevant lessons and observances. That halachas like Shabbos and the laws governing Jewish sexuality have never, ever in human history been more relevant than they are today. We've got to communicate this message with love and with caring and with sincerity and with joy. And we've got to do it very, very, very quickly. I believe that we only have maybe 5 or 10 years before we hit this turning point. And if we don't get our acts together by then, it's going to be disastrous. I believe we've got to step forward now. I believe that we can. And to be perfectly honest, I believe that we will. What's the order of the day? So, you might be misunderstanding me if you believe that I came here tonight to tell all of you that you should get out into the front lines of Kiryat Rechokim. Although I think that would be a very good thing. But that would be a fairly easy challenge for me to throw at you, and it's not going to affect you much before Yom Kippur. I have much more concrete, practical, and challenging recommendations I'd like to make. I used to work in what I would call kiruv, grabbing almost entirely secular Jews off the edge of the canyon and pulling them back from the abyss. Today, tragically, because I had to perform triage, a very small percentage of my time is actually spent doing that. See, that's really, in my mind, a second priority. Because I kept grabbing Jews from the abyss and bringing them back, but bringing them back to what? Where do I dump them once I've got them? And the problem is that there is so much corruption within the world of Orthodoxy that when I brought these Jews back, they weren't interested. Or even if they were initially interested because they were fooled by what their idealism, what they thought was in our community. But there's a whole phenomenon today of Balei Tshuva who leave again after 10 years or after 15 years. Because when they actually get involved, they're so disappointed with our values and with the lack of sincerity, with the Shalom Bayis issues, with the way the children are being raised, that they're just not interested in keeping their kids or themselves as part of this project. So my challenge is really much, much closer to home. You know, I think I'll start by going for the jugular, and I'll leave you with these recommendations. More than anything else, the Jewish nation needs beautiful models of what good Torah marriages look like. That is the number one tzorach of Klal Yisrael bizman hazeh. The number one. I was counseling a fellow last week. Now, this is only comical if you don't realize how widespread it is. But I'm counseling this fellow last week. And I sensed he was actually asking me some personal questions about his own life. But I sensed there was something going on, and I said to him, "Tell me something, how's your Shalom Bais?" And he was a little taken aback by the question. And he said, "My Shalom Bais is great." So I said, "When you say it's great, what do you mean by that?" He says, "Well, we fight, but they're not serious fights." That is the standard of great Shalom Bais in this generation. If you fight, but it's not serious fights. Remember Ari Levin, "Our leg hurts"? That used to be the standard. Today the standard is we fight, but it's not a lot of fights. By the way, when I actually pried a little bit deeper, the reason they don't fight so often is because they actually only speak for more than 10 minutes at a time. They only speak once every 6 to 8 weeks. You have a great marriage. Fantastic. I'm speaking here to the single guys as well as the married guys. It doesn't make a difference at this point in history. If you haven't read a good book on marriage in the last 5 years, get with it. If you're not married yet, time to prepare. When it actually hits, it's too late. My son came to me, smart boy, my son came to me a year before he decided to start going out in Shidduchim. And he said to me, "I can tell within about a year I'm going to be ready to get married. I have no idea what that means, and I don't think I'm ready." In his quintessentially altruistic fashion, he said to me, "I think I'm selfish, and I'd like to do something about that. Can you start preparing me now?" And my son and I got out Rav Dessler's Kuntres HaChesed, and we started. It's the very beginning. Start with the very beginning. And then when we were done with that, we started learning the pamphlets for Chasanim. Rav Volbe has an excellent pamphlet. Rav Friedlander has an excellent pamphlet. The River, the Kettle, and the Bird. There's spectacular, spectacular books out there. Unfortunately, you walk into a Jewish bookstore, they have sections on marriage, which may not be a good sign of the times. If you haven't read a book on marriage, you're all old enough. Get in there and start reading. You're not married yet? Ask your married friends questions. Ask your Rebbeim questions. You are already married, so start working. Rav Volbe told me, "Shigra is death to marriage. You cannot set up a great routine and then live with it for 5 or 10 years. It doesn't work that way. If you're really brave," I risk putting myself in cherem here, "there are two excellent books which I will recommend to you, which I think are life-changing. And I think every Jew should read these books. There's one for men called Mishkan Yisrael, and there's one for women called Ohel Rachel." Yeah, I read both. Yeah, I found them both life-changing. Really life-changing books for Rosh Langer. Obviously, there's a lot more to say about marriage, but you get the idea. If we don't have marriages that are beyond, we don't fight very often, then we have nothing to offer the secular world. Go to stage two. We need to help our children fall in love with Yiddishkeit so that they don't become the next entries in the demographic meltdown. And so that their smiles and their giggles can serve as the attraction for all of those secular Jews standing out there who are watching us, looking to see if we have something better. If you have children, or if you ever intend on having children, I'm going to make a radical suggestion. You've got to take a child-raising course. I teach, actually haven't taught it yet this year, but I have been teaching for the last 13 years, a course on raising kids, a year-long course on raising kids, which I give to about 100, 150 single ladies who are studying here in Yerushalayim for the year, aged 19 to 25. Why do I do that? I asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, if it was okay to teach child-raising courses to single people. He said, of course. When are they going to learn it? When they have kids, they have no time anymore. Now, the reality is that you don't really know what we're talking about in the course until you have kids. But at least you'll remember enough so you'll know what questions to ask when the child shows up. So if you have kids now, it's not too late. If you don't have kids, you're right on time. You have, here in Yerushalayim, you have personalities like Rabbi Orlowick. I saw on one of the posters out here that Rabbi Orlowick is somehow involved here. Yeah, so Rabbi Orlowick is one of the gedolim in Chinuch Yeladim today. I mean, he's an unbelievable resource. Bring him in. And there's many, many people out there. Thank God you're in Yerushalayim. There's many people out there who can give you amazing insights into what mistakes not to make and how to raise really happy kids who giggle and love their Yiddishkeit. Personally, if I ran the world, I would make the following change. Right now what happens is, a few months or a few weeks before somebody gets married, they enroll in chosen classes. And those chosen classes end and then they get married. I believe that the chosen class should instantly segue into a chinuch class because that's what happens next. And you've got to be prepared for that. It's a tragedy. It's unbelievable damage is being done by people who know zero about chinuch and are raising children. And think that, well, I'll just figure it out on the way. Revolver writes in the introduction to his book about chinuch that if you use chush and hargasha and assume that mistam it'll all come out okay, your kids are going to be destroyed. Because there's a chokhmah of how to raise children. Probably half my time today is spent answering chinuch shailas, mainly from parents. It's usually not the teachers who call, it's mainly from parents. And the parents themselves want to know, how can I protect my kids from the immense damage that's being done to my child in the school? How do I undo what the Rebbe's or the Moors are doing to them? I just had a case 2 weeks ago. The following happened. The beginning of the Zman. A close chaver of mine in America decided he wanted to prepare his child for first grade. He spent the whole summer learning with his pre-first grader, Pirkei Avos. And the father and the son together, Erev Rosh Chodesh Elul, made a siman Pirkei Avos. First day of the Zman, the father wrote a note for his son saying that my son just made a siman Pirkei Avos and I want the Rebbe to know what a choshev Talmud he has in the class. The father folded the note up, gave it to the boy, showed the boy what the note said, gave it to the boy, put it in an envelope, gave it to the boy, and asked the boy, please give it to the Rebbe. The boy came home at the end of the first day of school, happy. The father said, what did the Rebbe say about the note? Did you give it to him? So the boy said, I gave it to him. What did the Rebbe say? The boy's face fell, and he said, Rebbe never opened the envelope. Can you imagine? First day of class, kindergarten. The kid shows up with a note from his father saying, I just made a siman in Pirkei Avos. The Rebbe didn't have time to open the envelope. Okay, I admit, I'm holding our Jewish schools to a high standard. Yeah, at public schools in LA, they shoot people. Okay. But chinuch, what does Torah chinuch look like? I'll tell you something. Think about this for a minute. I went to perhaps the second or third finest high school in America. It was a secular high school. I went to Beverly Hills High School. At Beverly Hills High School, I took AP everything. I never had a teacher who had a bachelor's degree. Every single one of my teachers had a master's degree or a PhD, including the guy who taught gym. And it was a horrible experience. It was a horrible experience. The teacher who taught us AP English, she had a PhD. What did she have a PhD in? She taught AP English. She had a PhD in English. The teacher who taught us AP History, what did he have a PhD in? In History. AP Calc, he had a PhD in Mathematics. Do you know that 4 years at one of the finest high schools in America, I never had a teacher who had ever studied education? They were brilliant. I just couldn't understand a word they were saying. Then I got to UCLA. 4 years. Some of the most competitive departments in the world. English, science, history, math. All of them with PhDs. All of them published. How many of them had ever studied education? Zero. First time I ever had a teacher who had taken a course on education was when I got to the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Parents have to study how to be parents, and teachers have to study how to be teachers. And until we realize there's a chachma nechinuch, our homes and our schools are going to be a chilul Hashem. Marriage, kids, and the last thing I'm going to leave you with, and perhaps most importantly, because this is the closest to home, and this is the biggest chilul Hashem or the greatest kiddush Hashem. And maybe this is the thing you can apply the fastest before Yom Kippur. The world stands on three pillars. One of them is avoda. Avoda means that you work. One of the meanings of avoda in Chazal is that you work on your midos. Now, working on your midos does not mean attending a class where they spoke about Musar. That's not what it means to work on your midos. That's what it means to get a PhD in Musar. That has nothing to do with working on your midos. And you can go to a class every single week where the Rav gives spectacular Musar. And you can remain entirely corrupt, blown away by the Chidushim. You can write Sfarim on his Chidushim and never, ever, ever change. Avoda means you not only expose yourself to cognitive stimulation, but you also involve yourself in behavioral exercises to change the bad midos, and that you pray ma'umka deliba to Kodesh Baruch Hu to get in and change those midos. There's planting, there's building, and there's prayer. There's a cognitive element. I admit, you have to go to the shiurim, you have to read the Mesil Shasharim, you have to pop open a Chobos Halvavos every single day for 20 minutes. Every day, 7 days a week. But the cognitive element is not enough. You've got to work on yourself. Every day you have to do a little exercise, a little something. Something to make a change. Showing up for yeshiva every day and going home could lead to Chilul Hashem. What's the language of Chazal? It's like a person who said to a servant, could you bring a core of wheat up into the attic? And the servant did so, and then he asked him, when you brought this ton of wheat, 2,000 pounds of wheat, up into my attic, did you remember to mix in a kav chumten? Did you put a handful of preservative to make sure the wheat didn't rot? And the servant says, no, I didn't do that. And the man says, better you would have never brought the wheat up into the attic. It's an astounding metaphor. Do you understand what this means? Bringing the wheat up into the attic, that's learning Torah. The person brought a ton of wheat up into the attic. And Das Torah says, if you didn't mix in a kav chumten, if you didn't do something to build your shemaim simultaneously, better you would have never brought the wheat into the attic. It's going to be a chilul Hashem. We don't need from Jews like that. The single most important thing we've got to do is we've got to do avoda, serious avoda. And thank God, in every Torah institution in the city, there are madrichim, there's people who can tell you how to do it. In every Torah institution. And there are huge people, there are gedolim, who lecture in this city. Massive people. People who are older, who know what they're talking about. Who can give really expert hadracha. So either here in this space midrash, or traveling out at night, you've got to get involved in doing something. And now I'll try to end by making my point. I said to you that if I had to guess today what scenario it's going to be, the bright scenario or the dark scenario, I said I thought it might be the bright scenario. I'll explain. I'm going to ask you a question. and I need you to answer me very, very honestly. And I'm only asking you, I'm not asking the person sitting next to you. And I really want an answer. We're just on the edge of Yom Kippur. Ms. Tom, over the last few days, you did some sort of cheshbon nefesh. Every person in this room, in their heart of hearts, knows something that they could change. Everyone here knows something that they feel bad about. Something they would be very proud if they could make that change. Now, I don't want to know what that is. It's nobody else's business in this Beis Midrash. No one should ever know. It's between you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But every person in this room can think of something, something small, that really, really needs to be changed. It's not yet Yom Kippur. You can walk into Yom Kippur as white and pure and beautiful as you want to be. If you decide you want to step forward. Here's my question. If you're willing, before you walk out the doors of this Beis Midrash tonight, and that's crucial, because people say, yeah, I'll take care of it, I'm going to do it before Yom Kippur, or I'll do it before Shemini Atzeres, or I'll do it before I graduate college, or I'll do it before I die. If you're willing, before you walk out of the doors of the Beis Midrash tonight, say, you know what? I'm a little bit like Alex Singer. I can't wait! I can't wait to do the right thing! Tonight! September the 24th! I'm taking a step forward! If you believe that before you walk out the doors of this Beis Midrash tonight, you can make a promise to yourself and to Hashem that you'll make a specific change and have a specific change in mind before you leave the doors. If you are that sort of person, if you can do that, and again, I don't care what it is, it's no one's business, but if you can make a commitment now, please, stand up. You see why I'm so sure it's going to work out? Good evening. Make the announcement. Make the announcement. Yeah, please. So you'll tell everybody, though. Tell everybody. Though.